This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. During World War II, Private Samuel Barber was stationed behind a desk in New York, and he was frustrated. And at night, he composed music for the war. The Commando March became so popular that Private Barber was known nationwide as a composer in uniform, and the military transferred him to the Army Air Force with new orders: compose a symphony. During World War II, the U.S. government devoted an enormous amount of energy to creating classical music. Annegrette Fauser is an expert on how that music was used in the war. She's got a book called Sounds of War Music. It's called Sounds of War: Music in the United States During World War II. And Annegrette Fauser is a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in Music and Women's and Gender Studies. Annegrette, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us more about this. Why were Barber and other composers given the task of writing symphonic music?
During World War II, or during that period, music had a very different status in American cultural life than it does have now. Music was something important. And Barber and other composers were enlisted like any other male up to the age of 44. And it's kind of two confluences coming together. On the one hand, you have this reservoir of people who do music. On the other hand, you have a great value attributed to the music. And so the armed forces were very keen on exploiting this kind of culture for their own purposes, both for their own men in the sense of entertaining and educating the soldiers. There were about 10 million enlisted men. And on the other hand, to recruit music for the purpose of the Second World War. And what I was trying to show was that, in effect, music and the other arts were seen as a cultural weapon parallel and supporting the real battles that were fought in the battlefield.
So you talk about the value for the soldiers themselves. Now, was the music also composed for popular domestic consumption, or were you trying to prove to the rest of the world that we had high culture too?
Both. On the one hand, it was composed for the population here. But on the other hand, especially these kind of works were composed to show to the world that America had a high culture. That relates to a 1940s concept of culture, that classical music is an important contribution to the world, to national well-being, which we today probably cannot quite fathom. But Nazi Germany and other opponents were making the point that America was this country of savages. There is a quotation that I found in the archives where an official got very upset that Americans were painted as, and this is a quotation, tomahawk swinging savages over there in Europe. And so to counterbalance that, there was this sense of, we can do it too. There was a lot of chips on the shoulder. But it was also another element to that America ended the war about 2 years later than most of Europe. And so there was this sense that culture had traveled across the Atlantic with composers, with musicians, and just with, you know, the universe. And now culture was residing in the U.S. And the U.S., we were the light on the hill, and we were now the promoters and propulsors of culture rather than just of trying to keep up. So there were a lot of things going into that.
And of course, here at home, some of this music was being listened to. It was very popular here. And I've got a piece that we're going to hear now, or at least a part of it, a piece of music that is called The American Salute, and it was composed by Morton Gould. A little copyright infringement there. That's a familiar tune. But let me ask you about the composition, when that was composed, and did it get airplay? Is this a popular tune on the radio back then?
It was definitely getting airplay. It was actually one of the reviewers said if Uncle Sam could sort of compose anything, that would be the kind of thing he would compose. It was a popular piece that was written actually for a band, and that very quickly got picked up by other high school bands and military bands and other bands and got airplay in the US. There was a big interest in so-called patriotic music and music that had that feel-good factor that sort of rallied everyone together. And music's a powerful means to rally people together, to make them feel good. I mean, you can march along to this piece, and if you're following through the whole piece, then you have a moment where there's a bit of reflection and you can think about the sad things in war, but then you sort of end up with a big bang, major chords, big sound, hooray, we are Americans, isn't it great? So that aspect was part of the compositional world in World War II. It's an easy one from our perspective to look at and say, oh my goodness, how can people do that? On the other hand, it was an attempt of being part of that war effort. So one shouldn't easily and cynically dismiss it.
Right, and it's good music, albeit he's sampling. This is actually kind of a preview of hip-hop culture later on, where we'll be sampling other people's music. But was it played sort of at public events, and was there music written for films? I mean, was it somewhat more insidious, planted in places where we didn't know it was written for this kind of thing? Was movie music commissioned by the State Department, by the War Department, to sort of engender this feeling of patriotism?
The government in various capacities was very interested in instrumentalizing music. You had the propaganda ministry, which is in the US called the Office of War Information, who had its own music department and was very careful at using music, anything from popular music to classical music. You had the State Department involved in music in a sense of cultural diplomacy that organized concerts that sent people out. You had the CIA, the OSS then, right, later the CIA involved. You had Hollywood collaborating with the Office of War Information in producing movies, and in part really sort of getting avant-garde composers like Aaron Copland and others involved in composing for their movies. And you had the military producing documentaries. Sometimes there's a famous documentary called Memphis Belle that has a score by a composer called Gail Kubik. That's a very modernist score. So you have these visions of airplanes dropping bombs over Germany, doing the good thing, to actually very modernist music. And it's a sense of progress, musical progress, but also weapons technology progress, and it's all done for the good of the world.
Because you have this idea that you referred to earlier, the Nazis calling the Americans savages, which is, there's the snow calling the popcorn white, isn't it, in a way? But there they are. And also, we've got a problem because the Germans they have a lock. They have cornered the market on classical music, right? And so unless we take this back and show that we can do it too, we've got a problem. So we talked about the men involved in this. Now, were there women composers at this time?
There were women composers, but one of the not-so-happy sides of the book and of the research for me was that women composers seemed to actually retreat from the public sphere of composition. There were a lot of women performers. Women were super active during World War II in other capacities. But composers like Ruth Crawford Seeger and others actually stopped composing. Some of them picked it up again afterwards, but I haven't quite figured out why that was the case. My hunch is that there is such a long story of understanding composition as something that is masculine, public, and something that also may be self-involved, that the first step that women will be doing is saying, oh, should I really be composing or should I be knitting socks? So even a composer who continued to compose like Marion Bauer, she sort of went very much into composition to support the war effort by doing fundraising things, etc.
And there's an African-American composer who had quite a reputation by this time, William Grant Still. Tell us about his involvement.
William Grant Still was at that time the foremost African-American composer, very well known. He was part of the New York avant-garde since the late 20s. He was one of the most performed composers actually during that time. In 1930, he wrote a symphony called the Afro-American Symphony that even in 1933 was performed in Berlin by the Berlin Philharmonic, and his second movement, the Scherzo, actually had to be repeated. It was super successful. He was making his living as a composer, as a film composer, and he got very involved as a patriot and as an American in World War II. He composed various works, including as a commission in 1943, in memoriam for the fallen, for the colored soldiers who were had fallen in World War II, but he also wrote a fanfare for the Tuskegee Airmen. So for him, music became part of what is known as the Double V campaign, making African Americans and their contributions very visible at home and not just abroad. So fighting for freedom at home is the Double V campaign.
Let's listen to a little bit of the music of A Tribute to the Fallen Black Soldier. There's a bit of In Memoriam written by William Grant Still as part of the World War II project in symphonic music that is documented in the new book Sounds of War, Music in the United States During World War II. Annegret Fauser is the author and my guest this hour. And, of course, William Grant Still, there's a whole other story about what happens to his opera, Troubled Island, after the war that they'd hoped to, State Department thought would be a nice propaganda piece, send him around the world. Southern Democrats in charge of Congress didn't think that was a good idea, and it was scuttled. That story for another time. Tell us about the contribution. Where would a piece like that have been played? Who heard that piece?
That piece was heard for the first time by the audience of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. It was actually commissioned for the New York Philharmonic and got performed there. It was transmitted by radio. It's a piece, for those who sort of know their Dvorak, that echoes and picks up on the New World Symphony and sort of takes this spiritual-like motif that we have just heard and puts it into that symphonic realm of someone like Dvorak and uses music, this is actually a beautiful example, uses music as part of what is called then racial uplift. So it's a very political piece on so many levels. It was then played in many concerts in the U.S. It was actually a well-performed piece.
And when you talk about this idea of the multiple layers, one of them is patriotic and American. Is there a way to determine, certainly Dvorak reference to the New World Symphony, is there a way to tell by the ear that this is American music?
That's a very tough question and one that we have been debating in the field for a long time. Is there something like an American, a German, etc. music? I think what you have are sounds, signifiers that especially through World War II have become associated with this is American music. Commonly what gets associated in classical music with it is these wide open spaces, and you get that a little bit in Grant Still, elements that pick up on something that's spiritual or jazz or other things. And if you want to have a piece that is more, in inverted comma, modern, the opening of Star Trek is just really one of those that pick on these tropes.
You mean this? There it is, the promise of a new tomorrow, the ever-optimistic American view that there will always be a tomorrow and it will always be better. So that, I guess, is quintessentially American if there ever was one.
It's wide open spaces that are just waiting for manifest destiny.
Let me ask you about this. This is something that you use to teach, and you use it as a teaching tool. Tell us why and how.
I'm teaching two courses at UNC that deal with sounds of war, and one is a kind of survey that is co-listed with Peace, War, and Defense. And the other is an honor seminar that I've been teaching about World War II specifically. And There are a number of reasons. One is just a really fascinating topic to think about music and war and culture and war. The other one has to do with the fact that when you're looking at something in history that is sort of at a distance from today, it is something you can actually start thinking about issues, the way how culture gets used, the way how sound gets used. Music is one of the most seductive means. Imagine a movie without music. Imagine an advertisement without music. So music gets used. Imagine a protest rally. Imagine the march on Washington without "We Shall Overcome." It doesn't quite have the same impact. And so what I've found is that when you're teaching about this kind of historic material, especially earlier when I started teaching about that in 2007-08, at the height of the Iraq war, it allowed for my students, and some of them are in the ROTC or had friends and family who were in the military, to think about what was going on without having to confront it in today. So it's a bit different. 2013, things are slightly different. But in 2007-08, it became a space within which student had a safe space to articulate maybe comfort or discomfort, uses of music, questions about how culture could function as propaganda or as advertisement or as something to just bring people in. Now, I haven't just talked about the past, that this is the main thing. And really, it's a question of conscious raising and awareness. It's not about me telling students what to think. That is not okay. But it is something to have people think and especially open their ears. We are seemingly a very visual culture, and sound just hits us. But at the same time, once you become conscious to the way how sounds works. And so my big class, I always start that with some advertisements for the military.
And then they can tell that these sounds that have been surrounding them and infusing them are also deliberate. And so that's an important part of the class. I wish we had more time, but Annegret, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Annegret Frauser is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her book is called Sounds of War, Music in the United States During World War II. And this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.